The Tom Woods Show, episode 1343.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Policy Genius. No matter how much or how little you know about life insurance, you can find the right policy in minutes at policygenius.com. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and today we are going through a number of important themes in the development of American law over the centuries, very lightly because there's so much material here, but still enough to whet your appetite so that perhaps you will want to go learn more. And my guest today is Stephen Presser, who is professor of legal studies emeritus at Northwestern University's School of Law. He's also taught at Rutgers, the University of Virginia, and University College London. He holds an undergraduate degree from Harvard and is a graduate of Harvard Law School and was twice a Fulbright Senior Scholar at University College London. He is legal affairs editor of Chronicles Magazine and the author of the book we're going to be talking about today, Law Professors, Three Centuries of Shaping American Law. And I just want to make sure, I bet most people listening know what it means, but we will use terms like originalism, and I don't want people who are new to this stuff to be left in the dust. So by originalism, we generally mean that the Constitution ought to be interpreted with reference to its original intent. Now, within originalism, there's a diversity of opinion because there are other people like Randy Barnett following in the tradition of Lysander Spooner. When Lysander Spooner was writing about the unconstitutionality of slavery, they would speak about original meaning, that forget about the intent of the legislator or of the, in this case, the lawgiver or the constitution maker. Forget about the intent. It's more a question of what is the public meaning of these words? The words that are on the page, what did they mean at the time they were written? That's our reference point. But whether you're looking at the original meaning of the words or the original intent of the people who wrote those words, originalism nevertheless asks us to look to the past, to look to the document and its history to get some sense of what it's all supposed to mean. That concept, no doubt, will feature now and again in our conversation. So, Professor Presser, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
This is quite a book here, and a person can learn an awful lot by reading it. What I'd like to do is start with Blackstone, a figure a lot of people have heard, but maybe haven't really read or know much about. They know that his commentaries were very influential in U.S. history in terms of forming people's legal ideas. And when you hear them, well, to be sure, to a modern ear, some of it will sound quaint. There are parts of that'll sound – it doesn't mean they're wrong, but certainly to a 2019 ear where it seems like we're on another planet from him, it will sound that way. So I'd like to start with that, and then I want to see what in the world has happened since Blackstone's day. So first of all, a little biography. Who was Blackstone?
Well, I present Blackstone as the first modern law professor. He taught at Oxford in the 18th century, and he made the common law, which is the vast body of decisions over hundreds of years, available to English people and then later to Americans. And he systematized the law, dividing it up into public and private, and in areas that we would still recognize today as contracts, torts, property, criminal law, and made it in a form that people could easily understand. And in particular, the aristocrats who were his students at Oxford. And without realizing exactly, obviously, what he was doing, Blackstone laid the foundation for the rule of law, and in some ways, even the United States Constitution. And the Blackstone's book actually was the single best-selling volume in America in the 19th century after the Bible. So the man's influence is virtually incalculable.
So how does he conceive of the law?
Well, he believes that the law, believe it or not, is essentially based on a divine foundation, that to a great extent, the English common law, and ours too, incorporates Christian beliefs that you find in the New Testament. And if you look at the doctrines of contracts and torts and property and criminal law, you see that they all circle around what Blackstone calls gospel morality. That's his organizing basis. And another really intriguing facet of Blackstone is that he draws a very sharp distinction between the task of judges and the task of legislators. For him, the task of judges is just to tell you what the law is. It's the task of legislatures, in his case, Parliament, to change the law if it needs to be changed. But the stability of society and the proper ordering of relationships that people have to one another really depends on the judges not trying to make new law, but just reflecting the rules as they actually are. And for a long time, that was also the foundation of American jurisprudence.
All right. So with that foundation, now I'd like to move ahead. And anybody looking at the table of contents of your book and thinking, well, I'd like to pick out a few topics to discuss, is going to be deeply frustrated because you want to discuss every topic. And unfortunately, this is not possible. But I guess what I'd like to know is how we get from that view of law that's so ingrained in the American mind that, as you say, the texts enshrining it are read so widely that they're second only to the Bible, and yet we could get to a point where we, much, much later, we have critical legal theory, we have feminist critiques of the law, and so on. Let's start with, I'm naturally moving very, very far ahead, but you have a chapter on sociological jurisprudence,
yes,
which is something that I think most people wouldn't even see what the problem with that is. But can you first explain what it is? And is this something that we see before Lochner?
Yes, there's a bit of a crisis in the American legal system that begins in the late 19th century and that extends into the 20th. And you can see it in a variety of fields of law, most prominently perhaps in the law regulating railroads and the law regulating antitrust. The courts simply aren't equipped to deal with these new forms of businesses, and the legislature doesn't really do a good job doing it either. With regard, for example, to the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Congress feels pressure in 1890 to produce some kind of a bill to punish the trusts in order to satisfy the farmers and agrarian interests and emerging populism that you see in the candidacy of people like William Jennings Bryan. So they pass a very, very general bill that's almost impossible to interpret, and the courts don't do a very good job interpreting what's so mysterious and inept. And that leads to pressure on the law schools to try to think of new ways to think about what the courts might do. And that leads people like Roscoe Pound, who's the subject of that chapter on sociological jurisprudence, to say, well, what we really need to do is reform legislatures and think more deeply about the law and throw out some of these arcane doctrines that the courts are using to frustrate the emerging political desire for change. Later, that leads to a school called legal realism, and later that leads to critical legal studies and feminism and all kinds of other ways, essentially to change the traditional view of law into something that leads to radical change. The progressives in the early 20th and late 19th century are the beginning, but the critical legal studies people, the Warren Court, the liberals on the Supreme Court currently are all essentially doing the same thing. And it's all really rooted in a desire. And I think I might even suggest it's an illegitimate desire to use the courts for political change in a way that probably made old Blackstone spin in his grave.
Can we talk about the famous Lochner case, and not so much with regard to the federalism issue or incorporation or anything having to do with any of that, but just simply the way the case was argued? Because you could say that it was from a sociological point of view that they tried to make the case in favor of laws that would limit the number of hours that bakers could work, because the arguments were things like, well, if people work really long hours, it can take a terrible toll on them, which may be the case, but is not really the legal issue.
Well, that's right. The decision is notorious and regarded as the second worst decision that the Supreme Court ever rendered. Dred Scott indicating that freed blacks couldn't be citizens is regarded as the worst case. In Lochner's case, what the Supreme Court decided was the Constitution ingrains freedom of contract as the most important principle. And it's freedom of contract exercised by individuals. And so the court held that the state of New York couldn't tell bakers that they had to adhere to the state's guidelines, that they couldn't work for longer hours than specified or for a lower wage than specified. And it led to Holmes's famous dissent in that case, where he said that the Constitution doesn't actually have any theory in it, neither Herbert Spencer's social statics or the theory of the organic state. I think actually Holmes was not correct on that. I think the framers in the late 18th century really did believe that freedom of contract and property law, which followed from that, was fundamental. And I actually think I'm among maybe a few living law professors who think that the majority in Lochner got it right, and that traditionally freedom of contract had been the preeminent legal concept. Now, whether you could really maintain that in the late 19th and early 20th century, when industrial conditions had so altered and when the distribution of wealth was so different, is a very nice question. But as I think you're hinting, the pressure on the court became so enormous that finally, by the time we got to the New Deal, it wasn't until about 1937 that the Supreme Court completely repudiated Lochner and opened the way for the federal government and the administrative state to rise and assume the role that they have now. One of the theses of the book, though, my book, is that really you shouldn't do fundamental change by the courts. You ought to, as it were, bite the bullet and amend the Constitution if you want to fundamentally alter our constitutional order. To let the courts do it, I think, is fundamentally undemocratic. That was a bit of a long-winded answer, but I hope that addresses your point a little bit.
It does, and I don't want to assume, by the way, that everybody listening knows what we're talking about with this case. Lochner versus New York, 1905. It's a landmark, a very important case. As you say, it's more or less overturned at this point, but it dealt with the question of a law relating to limiting working time, and the court said that that violated the 14th Amendment. And so it took a hard laissez-faire stand. And I know people, I mean, maybe I'm one of them, who generally I do feel that people ought to be able to make whatever contractual arrangements they want, but that ought to be decided on as local a level as possible. And I don't really want the federal courts intervening, because one day they'll intervene for what I want, but more likely, the next day, they'll intervene to overturn what I want. I'd rather just make my own decisions. But what I was driving at was the way people who wanted to see the New York law upheld argued the case. It seems like they were arguing almost like a social advocacy kind of argument. Not so much, well, the history of the Constitution is such that we're allowed to have these laws, but more, look at all this evidence we've gathered about the bad effects that working long hours has on people.
Well, that's right. And that's a fair point, that really what the court is doing is some kind of sociological analysis. But when you sit down and you think about it, it's not really that different from what the Supreme Court did in the Obergefell case just a few years ago, when the court decided, given the place of marriage in our society, it's a fundamental violation of due process and equal protection not to allow same-sex couples to marry. The point being that once you start down that road, there's no stopping. So that if you're not bounded by history and the original understanding. There's no limits to what courts can do. And as you say, you might like a decision today, but the one that comes down next week may be against everything you stand for.
Now I want to fast forward way ahead. I was an undergrad in the early 90s, and even then I had become aware of the critical legal studies movement that really gained steam in the 1970s. And it just seems so far removed from the way Blackstone thought. I'm curious about, first of all, can you explain what the critical legal studies movement was? And did it just pop out of nowhere? Or was this something that little by little had been building steam or was building, as you seem to imply, on earlier developments in our the evolution of legal thought?
Absolutely. I mean, you can build a straight line from Oliver Wendell Holmes's work in the late 19th century. Holmes is the author of the famous statement that the life of the law is not logic, it's experience. And Holmes claimed judges really are unconscious legislators. They alter the law to meet the needs of the times. And that thought was picked up by people like Roscoe Pound, who was the sociological analysis of law person that we referred to a little bit earlier, and then later by a school of thought called legal realists, who basically said the same thing that Holmes did, that judges essentially decide the way they want cases to come out, and then they think up reasons for it later and try to fit it in to precedents, but really what they're doing is making law. Well, the critical legal studies people said essentially the same thing. I mean, if we were to boil down their thought, as you say, in the mid-80s to the 90s, basically what they would say is, let's be honest, law is just politics in another form. And what the judges are doing is making political decisions. There was also a heavy dose in critical legal studies of essentially Marxist thought. They were profoundly influenced by the Frankfurt School in Germany and by the Frankfurt School's ideas that cultural norms really flow from economic conditions, basic Marxism. So if you have that kind of a view of law, as you suggest, it's completely antithetical to Blackstone's view of law, where law really is divinely inspired and the product of the wisdom of the ages, and indeed their single right answers for all time to basic legal questions. Critical legal studies saw the world moving in a leftward direction. It peaked right before the fall of the Berlin Wall, when it looked like Marxist ideas, in fact, were not the wave of the future. And many people think that critical legal studies never recovered from that. But the idea dies hard. And we see in politics, for example, with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that socialist ideas are really still percolating out there in America, and they're perhaps stronger in the academy than in the rest of society. So the socialist, the kind of idealistic utopian notions of critical legal studies for a while really did capture the law schools. They're not as dominant now as they used to be, and there are fortunately some trends, and I explore these in the book, that point in the other direction. The jurisprudence of Justice Scalia, for example, and Clarence Thomas owes an incredible amount to Blackstone, and the work of the Federalist Society, which is the probably most important lawyer and student legal organization today, is really designed to bring us back to a sort of neo-Blackstonian understanding of the rule of law, and to mention a concept you referred to a little bit easier, federalism. In other words, the core principles of the Constitution that we actually first discover in Blackstone, separation of powers and divided government and a resistance to arbitrary power in any form. Critical legal studies, progressivism, legal realism, and a Holmesian approach to law all throw that away just in the service of accomplishing naked political goals. But if you're after something more than mere politics and law, then I think the Blackstonian approach still has some appeal. And that's, after all, why I wrote the book.
All right, folks, we're taking just a quick break so I can put something at the top of your weekend to-do list. And what's that? Look into life insurance. You know you need it, and you keep putting it off, but I hereby declare you may put it off no longer. Especially since, whether you're a newbie or a full-fledged expert, Policy Genius has a website for you that makes it easy to compare quotes, get advice, and get covered. It really is the easy way to get life insurance. I promise you this will be painless. In minutes, you can compare quotes from the top insurers, get the coverage you need at a price you can afford. You just apply online, and the advisors at Policy Genius handle all the red tape. They'll even negotiate your rate with the insurance company. No extra fees, no commissioned sales agents, just helpful advice and personalized service. And it's not just life insurance they make easy, by the way. If you're looking at disability insurance to protect your income, or homeowners insurance or auto insurance, they can help you get covered fast. So no matter how much or how little you know about life insurance, you can find the right policy in minutes at policygenius.com. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. Just to help people see this a little bit more clearly, can you maybe give us some practical consequences for American society if critical legal studies had really been able to completely dominate the law schools? How would, let's say, contentious decisions be decided differently?
Well, it's not clear that there'd be any standards that would be followed at all. We had, for example, Professor Mark Tushnet, who's now at Harvard, who was one of the leaders of the critical legal studies movement. And he said, I'm often asked what I would do if I were a judge. And he said, if I were a judge, I would put whatever I decided in language that was consistent with whatever people regarded as the then current school of jurisprudence, but I would basically do whatever I had to do in order to establish socialism, so that if critical legal studies ever took over, essentially it would be an end to private property, an end to stability, and an end to having any confidence in the way courts would decide cases. To use critical legal studies approach, it would be nothing but politics applied in the courts of law. And it would, in other words, bring a complete halt to the most sacred conception that we have in all of our jurisprudence, which, after all, is the rule of law. It's, to use John Adams' famous phrase in the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, that our government is a government of laws, not men. Now, that's a bit of an ideal, but what it means is courts do not act arbitrarily. They act according to established principles, established values, and indeed the thoughts that are engraved in the Constitution by the acts of the American people at our founding and later through constitutional amendments. So basically, if critical legal studies ever became established, and if judges who adhered to those doctrines ever became in a majority, we could simply kiss the rule of law goodbye. And the sad part is, during the Obama administration, there were a fair number of district and appellate court federal judges who I think really did embrace a lot of the critical legal studies beliefs. And I think that's been part of the problem for President Trump. When these judges, for example, on the Ninth Circuit, encounter his attempt to do what executives in our country have traditionally done, they can find rather bizarre ways around the law and issue injunctions stopping his policy initiatives. Now, eventually, when these things find their way to the upper courts, like the Supreme Court, they can be overruled. But in the meantime, you see frustration of the president. And I think if we had critical legal studies judges dominating the bench, you'd see executives and you'd often see Congress utterly and completely frustrated. In other words, you'd see popular government brought to a halt and arbitrary political desires on the part of the judges dominant.
Now, even with these people, I'm not interested in caricaturing them, but yet I can't help thinking about the legal philosophy that took hold after the Bolshevik Revolution, which was that if you want to be a judge in Bolshevik Russia, you don't need to have the formal legal training that in a bourgeois society you would need, as long as you have a good, fully formed revolutionary consciousness. Now, I'm not saying that that's all the critical legal studies people are saying, but what I am saying is, in light of that, I can't understand what legal education for them would look like, what the point of studying precedent would be, what the point of burying your head in law books could possibly be.
Well, you're absolutely right. And what one thing that one can say is you study all that to see what you shouldn't do, to see where your revolutionary principles differ with what courts have done, and to help educate you in correct thinking. But as you say, it makes a mockery of everything that we believe. The law really is our great repository of tradition and values. The horrifying thing is that from the thought of Oliver Wendell Holmes in the late 19th century onward, there's this tendency to throw it all away in the service of temporary political or social goals. And I don't know if it's just a weakness of human beings or what, but imperfect as we are, we tend to forget what law really ought to be all about. And in the pursuit of expedient social, sociological, or political goals, we tend to undermine the things that really hold us together. And as I say, it's remarkable that it goes back as far as it does. And maybe it's just a part of our fallen character as human beings.
You have a chapter called The Feminist Critique of Law. And is that, in a way, an outgrowth of critical legal studies, or are these two things on two entirely separate tracks? And what does the critique consist of?
Well, I think they're very much related. The feminist critique that we see in people like Catherine MacKinnon, who teaches at Michigan and occasionally visits at Yale, essentially suggests that if you take a look at the legal structure, it's basically a means of effectuating the power of the patriarchy, of old white men in control. And that's another way of stating the critical legal studies' purported insight that all law is politics. Feminist theory really does want radical change and a radical redistribution of resources and perhaps a radical reconception of traditional gender roles. I do see them as a piece of the same thing. Now, that's not to say, really, that both the feminists and indeed the critical legal scholars can sometimes offer powerful insight into some injustices in society. But the real question is, who ought to correct those injustices? Should it be the courts, or should it be the people themselves acting through their legislatures?
Well, finally, I'd like to talk about the resurgence in originalism, let's say, that we, of course, start to see in the later part of the 20th century. And that occurred against a backdrop of tremendous hostility, it seems to me. I mean, they're running completely counter to the way, let's say, left-wing legal thought had been going. This would be viewed as a horrific throwback to earlier times. So I'm curious about how it happened. And even today, of course, I think it's in large part thanks to the Federalist Society that there is diversity of thought out there. But I'd like to know also where you think the originalist movement stands today.
Well, I think it's the most interesting and the most traditionally valid school of legal academic thought there is. The basic idea of the rule of law that we began discussing, the Blackstonian notion that there are timeless values, that ours ought to be a government of laws, not men, is what originalism is really all about. And if you really do believe that there's a difference between law and politics, I think you end up as an originalist. I think you end up privileging the rule of law. I think you end up thinking that judges shouldn't be legislators. And as judges, as law students, as even some politicians watched what the courts were doing in the Warren era, and then later in the Berger Court with Roe versus Wade, and in our own time with the gay marriage decision and a lot of the other, let's call them fairly arbitrary, constitutional law decisions, I think a movement grew, and that's how the Federalist Society got going, of trying to return us to our basic values and trying to be more loyal to the notion of a government of laws, not men. Scalia has always believed that. He was enormously successful. I don't know if it had to do with his particular talents as a speaker or what, but if you read Clarence Thomas's opinions, you get the same powerful originalist view. And I think for the last, 10 or 15 years, basically what's been going on in the law schools and in the law reviews is a dialogue with originalism, and in some ways a concession that its basic premise about the rule of law is correct. Now, there have been attempts sort of to co-opt originalist thought, the so-called new originalists, who are really, in a way, neo-Holmesians, who essentially suggest that even back at the founding, there were all these loose interpretations of the Constitution, and there was all this freedom for judges to implement constitutional principles that were so broad that they could change over the ages. But I think in a way, that's a concession to the extraordinary long-standing power of this basic notion of the rule of law and this basic Blackstonian idea that judges should not be legislators, but the judges should recall us to the timeless values that we find in our history and in the Constitution. And that's a powerful, I'm tempted to describe it as an almost religious call that resonates really with lawyers at some level. As you indicated, if the critical legal studies scholars were in charge of law schools and the bench, you'd wonder whether you were just doing the will of the Politburo if you were a judge. With originalism, with Blackstonian notions, with the rule of law, with our basic concepts of separation of powers and restraint of arbitrary power, I think we're after something nobler. And I think that's the appeal of the Federalist Society. And that's what I tried to capture in writing this book.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you the same question I've asked a couple of other legal scholars I've had on recently, just because I'm just curious. Obviously, we're all observing the Supreme Court, and we all know full well that at some point in the relatively near future, there will be a vacancy. One way or the other, there'll be another vacancy. And if this president is the one who fills that vacancy with a relatively young person, it could solidify a conservative court if, presuming that we don't wind up with a David Souter or two and Justice Roberts, somebody has to keep an eye on. But the long and the short of it is, it would not be a hard left court for a long time. Is there a handful of particular names whose nomination would fill you with delight?
Well, there's one, and I suspect it's everybody's favorite. It's Amy Coney Barrett, a former Notre Dame teacher, an extraordinary woman with seven children, two of whom are adopted, and I think one or two of whom are disabled, who's a deeply committed Catholic, who clerked for, I believe, the conservative Supreme Court justice, possibly Thomas, and who is another incarnation of Scalia and Thomas. I think she would be just fabulous. And I think her views are so profoundly favored by the Federalist Society and by originalists that her confirmation hearings are going to make the Kavanaugh hearings look like a kindergarten proceeding. The left will fight very hard to keep her off the court, but I think she would be absolutely wonderful. There are a few others, but no one stands out as prominently as she does.
All right. That's an interesting answer. Of course, I've heard her name, but I had two people in a row point to a Fifth Circuit judge named Don Willett and say that he is also in the Scalia tradition, that they're pulling for him. But now one of them clerked for him, so that may have, influenced his thinking. But so.
Well, and I'm a little conflicted about this, but I mean, I'm assuming it will be Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who retires soon. And I think there's something to be said for replacing her by a woman, maybe not an enormous amount, but something. And I think Trump would be making an interesting move if he appoints a woman. And that's why I think Amy Barrett is the right one.
And I think that's why she's the likely one. I mean, I think it does come down to that. Well, in any event, the book is Law Professors, Three Centuries of Shaping American Law. I am linking to the book on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1342. And my thanks to Professor Presser. Thanks for your time.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
All right, folks, that's our episode. If you enjoy and appreciate what I'm doing, I would be delighted if you would join me as a supporting listener of the show and be part of what I call the Tom Woods Show Elite. Don't you belong in that group? Think about it. Don't you belong there? Well, the way there is through supportinglisteners.com. Thank you very much, and I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.